Hi, I'm Norm Shealy.
NormShealy.com.
You are listening to Infinite Consciousness, your infinite access to the world
of the mind.
Welcome to Infinite Consciousness tonight, and thanks for listening. This is Eva Herr, and tonight I have with us Dr. Ashok Gangadane, and we're going to talk about the work that he's doing with consciousness and his Global Commission on Consciousness and Spirituality and the work that he's doing with linguistics and consciousness. How are you, Dr. Gangadane?
Fine, thank you, Eva. Great to be with you tonight.
Thank you for coming on. So why don't you tell us a little bit about you and where people can find you and how you came to do what it is that you do before we get started.
Okay, well, by the way, my name is Ashok Gangadane, and I'm a professor of philosophy here at Haverford College, which is outside of Philadelphia, founded by the Quakers about over 175 years ago. I'm in the philosophy, I teach philosophy, and I'm a philosopher. And as I said, 43 years here. And my work has been to really see how to bring our diverse worlds of wisdom and philosophy on a planet together, because philosophy seeks to see the whole. Wisdom, philosophia means love of Sophia. Sophia is wisdom, the infinite feminine. And it is an attempt to see the whole picture. And that's what philosophers have been doing for eons. So my work has been to see if it's possible. I'm trained deeply in the Western European traditions, coming out of Plato, Socrates, Aristotle, all the way through into contemporary times, focusing on logic and ontology. Ontology is the science of reality, and logic is the science of consciousness. And those have been my focal points. But then I began to see that we don't have quite good literacy and competence when we start to cross worlds. If we're in the European mind, can we enter the Hindu mind? The Chinese mind, the Buddha way of thinking. Can we cross borders of worldviews? And I found no real guidance or clarity there. So that's been my focus for over 40 years. And I'm seen as a pioneer in opening up the horizon of global consciousness or global awareness and intelligence, which means a competence and literacy to cross diverse worlds with integrity and understanding.
So how did you start what happened to make you start doing this?
Well, I felt the pull when I was very young, before I even knew philosophy, to find a coherent way of seeing the whole. That was just a deep instinctive pull. At one point as a boy walking the streets of New York, I was born in Trinidad, family from India. I was born in Trinidad, moved to Jamaica, came to New York, and grew up in New York City as a young person. And eventually, I did my undergraduate work at City College of New York and went on for my doctorate at Brandeis University outside of Boston. And as a boy walking the streets of New York City, I saw so many apartments and I began to wonder how many people are suffering in these places. And something grabbed me and I just, I didn't understand. I was like 14 years old. And I began to feel after this jolting experience. The next day I got up and started writing, always seek the universal light, enter the universal light. Had no idea what that really meant, but something was calling me and pulling me. And it was only years later, after I got my doctorate and my deeper into wisdom, that I began to see that's what the universal light is. It's an attempt to see and open your consciousness so you can see a universal connectivity of reality. So that's really what called me. And over these years here at Haverford, I eventually founded the Global Dialogue Institute. Global Dialogue is the deepest kind of dialogue across worlds, which is what global means, to bring world and worldviews into conversation and find deep common ground in that diversity. And that's Global Dialogue. So I founded that Global Dialogue Institute and had many projects unfolding out of that. And I joined with other leaders to form a World Commission on Global Consciousness and Spirituality, which you mentioned in the introduction. People like the Dalai Lama and Desmond Tutu and Jane Goodall and Wangari Maathai, who won the Nobel Prize, are examples. Bob Thurman, the Buddhist thinker who advises His Holiness the Dalai Lama, are examples of people on this commission with me. And the World Commission on Global Consciousness, think about it, a World Commission on Global Consciousness. What is global consciousness? It is this dilated awareness that has the sensitivity to dance across and between diverse worlds with common understanding. And we all agree, although we come from very different fields and approaches, that this kind of global consciousness is now vital for the human family on this planet. And that's really what the commission is seeking to do.
Well, let me ask you a question. One of the problems in science and religion and spirituality today is that word consciousness, because it has so many definitions to it. And people use that word dialoguing, having a different definition and not realizing the other person has also a different definition. So for clarity purposes here, what is your definition of that word?
Well, there are two words you use, dialogue and consciousness. And the word dialogue means dialogos, through the logos. I use the word logos from the Greek as one of the words for this global space, whether you call it Allah, Yahweh, emptiness of the Buddhist tradition, or Om, whatever word you use for that, that's a logos, the logosphere. And dialogos means through the logos. Most people, when they're in conversation, they don't realize they have a lens that has been cultivated all their lives through their culture, and it's a certain perspective, and they see everything, themselves included, and their world and reality through that lens. They see the other through their lens. And when people get together from different worldviews, imagine a circle where a Buddhist and someone in the Chinese tradition and African tradition and Christian tradition, to mention a few, and the Muslim tradition are sitting around a table talking to each other from their lens. That's not dialogue. That's often monologue. Monologue means through their lens they see the other. And that really violates the otherness of the other. So dialogue through the logos means you have to step back, open up your lens, set open space so that you can enter into the perspectives of the other and see the world through their eyes. And when that happens, there's a dilation of your heart mind so that you can see multiple worlds as you cultivate that literacy and skill in dancing and dialogue across worlds. So that's what dialogue means. Dialogos, through this logos. And it's hard to achieve deep dialogue. In my institute, I've developed what's called deep dialogue to mark real dialogue as crossing across worlds with this kind of critical intelligence. And consciousness, in the other word, which is also so hard to articulate, and that's what philosophy hopefully seeks to do, it has to do with awakened rational awareness, and where you make sense of the world, where you can see things in connectivity and connect the dots. And with that, your energy of awareness and conscious mind begins to dilate to make sense of the world. So that's one approach to consciousness.
So when you're talking to these people from all different aspects of the world, especially in the Western world, how do you get them to be on the same page with you to understand what you're talking about?
Well, one of the first things we seek to do is precisely to get this issue of the lens out in the open. When people begin to realize that, oh, I see the world from a Christian lens, or I'm an American citizen and I see it from our American way of life. When people begin to become aware that they have a lens and that someone from a very different culture has a different lens, this is one of the starting points from beginning to get to the same page, because the appreciation of deep diversity is a prerequisite for entering into real dialogue. For example, one of my colleagues who, as a young man, a theology student, went to live with the Lakota indigenous peoples up in Montana, in a way unconsciously thinking he would bring the faith, his faith of Jesus to them. Actually, after living with them and breaking bread with them and sitting around the fireplace with them, after 2 or 3 or 4 weeks, he began to have a deep change in his lens. He began to see the world differently. And he realized these people see the world more magnificently than he ever did. The living mountains and skies and nature and trees and buffalo, they're all interconnected. So he had a deep shift in his lens. And this so transformed his life that his whole career, this is Professor Jurek Cousins, who passed away recently, but he's known for being the pioneer who opened up the 24 volumes of World Spirituality to appreciate the different spiritual ways across the peoples of this planet. It's just an example of when you begin to come to a common ground that celebrates real diversity and honors it and respects it. You begin to then dilate through dialogue and come to common ground.
So do you have regular meetings with these people? How does this thing get facilitated?
Well, there are many ways through my institute, for example, or the World Commission, or another eminent group called the World Wisdom Council. I'm working with another cluster of world leaders, and there's some overlap. And more recently, there's another group of very eminent thinkers at the forefront of the shift on the planet called the Evolutionary Leaders. And we are all in our ways having different meetings and vast constituencies. But in my Global Dialogue Institute, for example, I may have a meeting in New York City with the Partnership of Faith of the eminent religious leaders throughout the city who are trying to enter dialogue. And so when we go and meet with them and have an intensive, a one-day intensive, where I take them through the seven stages of deep dialogue, which is a meditation that I performed in the late 90s, about 1997, before I brought it into the Global Dialogue Institute as part of this technology, when people go through the seven stages of deep dialogue, they realize, oh my God, there's a whole deeper way to be together in sensitivity, to listen deeply, and to speak from a more open, dilated space. And alchemy begins to flow in meeting like that, or from meeting with civic leaders who are in the civic space, have very different perspectives, but haven't really learned in the deep democracy, how to open up the space of dialogue in that civic space, not just to have blowouts and power plays across party lines and ideologies, but to truly listen to one another in that open space, which is the heart of democracy.
Is it possible to walk us through the seven stages so we can, my listeners can understand?
Well, yes. I mean, the first stage, for example, is that moment where a person begins to get it. Oh my God, I've been treating this other person, whether it's a spouse, suppose it's a guy who has just having breakdown in communications consistently and chronically in a codependent dynamic with his spouse, and realizes, you know, you hear men are from Mars and women from Venus. That's a metaphor for this. They're different worlds speaking different languages. Stage one is when you realize, as this colleague I mentioned, who realized that Lakota live a different world and he needs to understand it. It's a shock of realizing that the other is a different world. That's stage one. When you finally see you've been living all of your life interpreting others through your lens, and you reach this critical moment of dilation and awakening, which is also a shock to realize, wait a minute, they have a different view, a whole different world. Do I dare enter it? Am I courageous enough to be vulnerable, to not to close my lens, but to step back, dilate a bit, and step into their world, into their shoes. That's stage one.
Can I ask you a question here?
Yes.
When talking to fundamentalists about enlightenment, which is basically what you're talking about, right? How to get to that stage?
Right.
Okay. When talking to a typical fundamentalist who's not been exposed to this, what kind of reception do you get from them? Do they understand what you're talking about?
No, it's a great question. It's a great question. And one of the great challenges is that stage one, I only got to stage one in giving you, you asked me to run you through the seven stages.
Sorry.
It's all right, because stage one is one of the important questions at stage one is someone who is so lodged in their lens and their worldview and are convinced that they have the truth. And it doesn't have to be a religious person. It could be a civic American who believes the American way is the right way, or their perspective as a Republican or a Democrat or a Tea Party or whatever it is the right way. And they're convinced of it, and they're not going to budge. Or if it's a pro-life or pro-choice, whatever it may be, Big Bang or Genesis, whatever your worldview, if you're locked into it, you can be a scientist and be what I would call an ego-mental scientist who holds his or her lens of science as the absolute measure of what is truth and meaningful and real, and is not going to question that. They will reject religious outlets, for example. So fundamentalism, in this sense, comes in many, many forms. If you privilege your lens and you absolutize it, then you're not committed to enter into the dialogue process usually. That's almost a mark of a closed-minded person who, in this sense, is a fundamentalist, and it's extremely difficult to get to stage one, to open it up. So you're quite right to raise that question.
So you're basically addressing the people who have crossed that borderline and who are seeking or feeling the void of needing something more or the emptiness of something that they know there's something more. That would be the group that you would be talking to, right?
Not necessarily. No, those are the people who are ready to move into a deeper stage, but the ones who are not. Deep dialogue is meant to reach, because so much of our planet, our people, living in a kind of this kind of fundamentalist privileging of their own lens and worldview, and have not yet reached the point where they're saying, I'm willing to open and cross into a dilation of moving into the space of dialogue. And so it's meant to really deal with people like that. Let me give you an example. A family member of mine is a fundamentalist Christian. Very early in his life, he saw Jesus and he became a devout Christian in the Bible Belt Campus Crusade for Christ. And he came to me and said that Jesus spoke to him and said that I will be saved when I be ready to kneel with him and pray and accept Jesus into my heart and be saved. Just before I was about to go to India, by the way. This was in 1971. And I looked at him. I know he loved me. And I really believed he meant well for me. But my whole life flitted before my mind when he asked me, at this moment, kneel, pray, accept Jesus, and don't go to India. It was in the directory. And I had to go through my deepest heart search and realize, no, I believe there are alternative multiple ways to reach awakened mind and Christ consciousness and higher life. Not only one way. And I was not ready to enter into what his terms were. Now, this is a brother that I love, and we've had a deep dialogue going for years. And it took me years of my own journey. I went to India. It shifted my whole lens. And when I came back in 72, I began to teach Hindu thought and Buddhist thought. And because my question as a philosopher was, how do we cross worlds? And I really believe that this was a vital question for humanity that we needed to make headway on. We need to open that up. So over the years, as my work unfolded and I began in teaching these different worldviews and trying to open up the diversity and common ground, I began to see that Jesus was one of those great awakened minds who were trying to call people to a higher lens outside of the ego lens, out of a naive fundamentalism. When he says, you've got to die to be born again, everything he said to his disciples was really along the lines of being a deep dialogue being. Because when you rise out of ego mental mind into dialogue, dialogos, the sacred space, and when John began his gospel, in the beginning is the logos, and the logos became flesh, this magnificent language, and this Christ consciousness calling people to the higher place, when he said, when I was in prison, you visited me, when I was hungry, you fed me, he was trying to educate them in this higher consciousness of dialogue. That's when you find the I-thou. You find yourself in the other. So I was able to eventually use this Christ with my brother to say, which Christ are you speaking? The ego-based, ego-mental Christ or the awakened Christ for the planet who really is the Logos in the flesh, who calls us into deep dialogue? And whenever Jesus spoke this way, his disciples would ask him because they were in the ego lens. And they would say, unless you die, you can't be born again. He would say, must we enter our mother's womb? He says, no. For those who have ears, let them hear. But what are those ears? The ears of awakened consciousness, of deep dialogue. So I think the way to speak to a fundamentalist could be a Muslim fundamentalist, because the call of to Allah is the call to awaken, as the Sufis understood. The Sufis are the Muslims who understood this deeper pathway into surrendering to God, which is what Islam means, surrender to God. So it could be a scientist who is also closed. When Newton had his lens and Einstein shifted it, he was shifting and dilating the lens of science to space-time continuum. And now the frontier thinkers in physics and biology and the sciences are seeking to find a unified field. and they're getting things like non-locality and the butterfly effect and black holes, and that's blowing away the old fixed lenses and opening up a deeper lens. So science itself is a growing enterprise that realizes we have to get a more powerful lens to understand the unified field of nature. So you could be so it's meant to dialogue with all humans who are more lodged in their lens, and to help them come to see that there are alternative ways of processing reality. And if you could get them in their terms to recognize it. So in my brother's case, I got him to see, are you speaking about the ego Jesus or the awakened high Jesus who is calling us to a higher culture? He's calling us that we had to die to pass into this higher space. Dying here means let go of that fixated lens so you can move into the place of compassion. All of Buddha's teaching is along this line too. So I began to see a remarkable, resounding consensus across the planet with all of our great elders in different traditions who are trying to model for humanity the letting go of the more limited closed lens and opening up a space of I-Thou and deeper dialogue.
You brought up the butterfly effect. I'd like for you to explain to my listeners what that means, because a lot of people don't really realize, especially now with science talking about quantum entanglement and the unified field, that the thoughts or the action of one literally can affect the others on the other side of the world. Is that what you're saying?
Well, yes, I think it's exactly right, because the consensus of the wisdom of the planet, once you cross into this holistic unified field of interconnectivity, whatever name you call it, you could call it Yahweh, you could call it Allah, you could call it Om, you could call it Tao, you could call it emptiness or Shunyata in the Buddhist way, you could call it the grand unified field, whatever you call it. The consensus is that reality is a boundless, open field of deep interconnectivity where everything is in flow and interconnectivity. And we need a higher calculus of the mind, a mind-operating process. We humans, in our journey of maturing as whole human rational beings who are awakened, to have a powerful script, like a higher mind-operating process, to surf and enter into that unified field of interconnectivity, which is what awakened rational moral consciousness is.
So what does that mean once we are able to dialogue on this level? What ultimately will that mean for not only our personal selves, but for the entire mass population of the world?
Well, imagine if we were able to move in that respectful dialogue, because to enter into this Logos Sophia space, that's one of the words I like to use the word from logic and reason, logos and sophia, and not just logos in the older sense of the ego base, but logos sophia as a name for this boundless, global, infinite freedom where all our worldviews and scripts and perspectives and cultures emerge out of. If we are able to find the technology and literacy to enter and live in this flow, athletes call it when they're in this high space of peak performance, in the zone, when they go into the zone spontaneously on the playing field or jazzing together, and they somehow find this magic moment where they just become one with the music. That's Zen in the moment, the many ways of wording that. But if we get this literacy to mature out of the ego-based, ego-mental consciousness that keeps us fragmented and broken off from ourselves and from each other and from relationships and love and compassion and respecting nature, if we can cross into this field, it's sacred space. Everything is sacred. We are sacred. Our others, significant others, and all our significant others are sacred beings. And if we live that calculus, which is what ethics and spirituality and awakened rationality is, then that is where the human family begins to flourish together in sustainable cultures.
So the bottom line is we could have peace in the world and in our lives instantaneously if everyone were to do this.
Well, yes. I mean, and this is really what's at the heart of the enterprise like the World Commission on Global Consciousness, you know, the World Wisdom Council, or evolutionary leaders enterprise. There's a consensus that how we're using our minds, our consciousness makes our world. And if we're living in ego-based culture, we're going to have an ego-based world, with that fragmentation and polarization and genocides and holocausts and divorces and breakdowns and abuse of one another in that kind of violent way. We don't realize that ego-based consciousness has been seen by our elders to be a place of suffering, to use Buddha's words. And certainly in the Bhagavad Gita, when Arjuna breaks down on the battlefield in the war with his own family, he drops his weapon and turns to Krishna, the own voice, and says, Krishna, help me. I need your help. I'm in a lost situation here. And Krishna uses the technology of yoga to help him move into this higher own space, to become an awakened martial artist, and to live in a way of nonviolence. So, yes, to gain the literacy of deep dialogue life, the life of recognizing yourself in the other, that's I-thou, as Buber would call it, rather than I-it. The ego-based makes the other an it. It makes itself an object. And when you objectify another human, all kinds of consequences follow from that, rather than standing in the presence of the sacred other that allows him, her, to speak in their own voice, in their own sacred space. That's where the awakened culture has to mature into.
You keep using the word evil. That's not something that I normally hear on my show, because remember, I usually interview scientists. What is that? Is that something that comes from our own minds, or is it something outside of us?
You meant the word ego, right?
Evil. You keep saying evil.
Not evil. Ego.
Oh, ego. You didn't use evil, so it was ego. I misunderstood.
I didn't think the word evil. I mean, ego. E-G-O.
Okay.
Is it just a name for that mental process where the ego-based consciousness, the ego culture, privileges its own worldview. So I'm sorry you misheard that. It's not. I'm not using the word evil, but ego.
Okay, gotcha. I'm on the same page now. Okay. So tell us what else that you are doing, because I don't know everything you're doing. You don't have a book out there, so I haven't been able to sit in my, bed and study it every night. Tell us what else that you're doing to shift consciousness in the world and how individuals can contribute to that. And by the way, you never told us where to find you. Where can my listeners find your work?
Well, one place you can find me is my website, awakeningmind.org. Awakening Mind, www.awakeningmind.org is a website where they can find me. And that will lead to other websites. But there are many of my national videos and radio interviews and essays and so forth on that Awakening Mind site. And the link to the World Commission on Global Consciousness. I've been a television host in Philadelphia for 5 years, and my show in the last year was called Global Lens, Opening the Global Lens. And I hope you're hearing that word, L-E-N-S, the lens of the mind. And so having been a professor for 43 years and working through my institute and these various partnerships with world leaders, is all in a concerted effort, including my books. I've got 3 books so far, and Out of Sounds True, they did a 6-CD audio performance of one of my books called The Awakening of the Global Mind. And that is out there for 2 years now, along with my books and essays. And I'm now working on another book meant for the mass culture, to make this global wisdom available, and the title is Awakening Global Enlightenment, or Shift, our Evolutionary Shift and Maturation of the Species. And all of these are ways in which I'm joining with others in partnership, like-minded individuals with all of our diversity, to help bring this awakened wisdom to the planet in a mass way, to help bring a mass shift. And what all individuals can do. For example, our evolutionary leaders group are thinking of having a convening in Washington, D.C. on 11-1-11 next fall in order to help bring this call to conscious evolution out in a more public mass way. So we are focused upon trying to bring this wisdom of our great elders about awakening consciousness as the most powerful transformative force on the planet. The greatest activism that we can perform is to come to the awareness that we make our worlds with our minds. And if we ego mind, we have an ego culture, an ego world. And our great wisdom teacher said that is not the best we can be. In fact, that is counterproductive and dysfunctional. The fragmentation, polarization, objectification of each other, of nature, is a form of violence, unintended violence, that we need to mature out of that ego sapien to become a logo sapien, to use that metaphor. The evolution of a caterpillar to a butterfly, I playfully say from an ego pillar to a Buddha fly, is what we're called on in this moment of great shift to a sustainable culture. And each person has to take responsibility. You can't blame the administration or other people. If you are living, without thinking about it, uncritically, an ego-based form of consciousness, and if the elders of our planet are right, that egoing produces an ego culture and an ego environment, that is not the best we can be. And if we can make the link of the crises we face in our personal lives, our interpersonal lives, our intercultural, interreligious lives on the planet, and look at the crises we're facing, which threaten our sustainability, if we realize that this is traceable to how we're using our minds, that is, in a way, the ultimate technology, the technology of consciousness. We usually don't think this way, but when we realize that egoing is a practice, is a pattern, is a technology of consciousness, of world-making, and there's a choice, as Buddha said, we don't have to use an ego-based way of being a human. We can upgrade our technology to a mindful life, as Zen would call it, as Christ would call it, as Krishna would call it in yoga. All of these wisdom traditions are calling and urging us to pay attention to how we mind, what technology we're using. So if we want to bring this world that is sustainable, where humans and the human family as a whole can flourish together in sacred nature, we have to find a way to shift our patterns of minding. And that's what every individual on the planet is called upon to do by our great elder teachers.
Okay, I have a question for you here. Some people, when they listen to someone saying, you're acting out of ego mind, they go, what the heck are you talking about? Can you give us an example of acting out of ego mind so that they can go get that aha moment?
That's a great question, you know, and you know, the word ego, we usually think of me, ego. It doesn't have to even be that someone can be thinking of we and us. You can be part of a culture or a tribe or a community and think, I'm not thinking about me specifically, but us, whatever it may be, a scientist, Christian, Muslim, Hindu, Buddhist, whatever it may be, you can have an us point of view and still be ego-mental. The key code word is, are you privileging the lens of your mind and perspective? Are you taking a perspective and an outlook that you privilege? The word is called privileging it, that this is the way to see truth and reality and what is meaningful and valuable. And that's a mono-lens. Monologue is taking your worldview to be the measure of reality. And it can even be that, oh, it's all a matter of opinion. It's all relative. That's another lens, relativism, that there is no truth. It's all just opinion. That's all the cultures have, are different opinions. You have your truth, I have mine. Well, that's a lens too. And so you can have many forms of this privileging of your lens. That's what the elders are calling ego-mental. I'm using the word ego-mental because we want to call it out into the open. And we could call it mono-lens, monologue. There are different ways of wording it. So each person should ask himself, herself, am I unconsciously, without having thought about it, or perhaps even deliberately, because I'm so convinced that my lens is the right one and the only one, am I really in monocentric thinking? So that is another word for the ego-based way of thinking.
Okay. I got an email from someone yesterday saying, I'm beating myself up because I keep thinking these thoughts of what I'm... You know, I'm doing this poorly, or I'm doing that poorly, or something's wrong with this person, or something's wrong with that person. And I said, my response, because I don't know who this is, was stop thinking and just be and observe reality around you. And she wrote me back and said, if we were to just be, and this person is a professional, like a doctor or a lawyer, I'm not going to say because I don't want them to be identified, but She said, if we were just to be, wouldn't we just sit under a tree and sip lemonade all day? So could you explain that a little bit better, how someone could apply this to their lives, maybe help that woman understand more clearly what I was talking about?
Well, yes, Eva, this is a good point you made, and I think you instinctively did exactly what the elders, the wisdom elders, were saying. Thinking, if you take the yoga away, for example, the ego mind, with its chatter and its opinions and its judgment and the way it operates, which leads to a midlife crisis and dysfunction. Lord Krishna, in his version, trying to teach Arjuna yoga, was trying to help him, you know, cross into the yoga zone. And yoga, yoga has become popular in our American culture now, on almost every street corner. But it's often, I wonder if it's really taught in the way it's meant to. Yoga is the quieting of the ego consciousness. It means stop ego thinking so that you can go into the own dilated thought, a higher form of thought. So in other words, ego thinking is not the only thinking in town. The wisdom teachers have been saying there's a higher consciousness, a higher way to think, an integral, holistic, dialogic way to think that is much more effective in living in the world. And it's not a matter of stop thinking and sitting under a tree and staring at the wall or contemplating your navel. That's not what the great teachers are saying. The Zen language is, when you chop wood, chop wood. When you carry water, carry water. What does that mean? It means be fully mindful in your activity. Be present. That's what martial arts is, by the way. And believe me, martial arts is effective. It's peak performance. Here's another user-friendly way. When athletes have those magic moments of going into the zone, imagine a runner who's been ego running. The coach has been coaching her, and she's been saying, I'm running, I'm breathing, I'm moving my arms, I'm raising my knees, I'm leaning, and all of the ways that the ego would try to analyze it. And then after 3 years, running on a nature trail, she suddenly has this magic feeling of just moving almost through a barrier into running, in that blissful state of being the running. I use a marker to mark when you've gone into the zone. And that's really when you're in peak performance. Mm-hmm. So the answer to your question is that when you stop ego thinking and you go into awakened thinking, you are more effective in peak performance than you could have imagined. And that's the way you want to be a doctor or a lawyer or a teacher or a lover or a father or mother, a citizen. You want to be mindful 24/7, which is what wisdom is calling us to be. So the opposite is true. When you realize that your ego minding is stressing you out, it's making you dysfunctional, it's breaking up your relationships, you objectify other people, you're not communicating, all kinds of violence comes out of it. That is not a functional way to be in the world. That's not a way to move graciously in the world and effectively. So the opposite is true, and it's just a much more helpful way, an organic way to be a holistic being.
So we have about 10 minutes or 12 minutes. Excuse me. I wanted you to take a few minutes to talk about whatever you want to talk about, but I also want to ask you this question. Many people think that just because someone becomes enlightened, that they never have bad things happen in their lives. Now, I have had one of those experiences. I still have things that don't feel good happen in my life. What I have found that has changed is that my perspective, or the way that I respond to those things, is differently now. Does that make sense? Do you agree with that? I mean, just because you're enlightened doesn't mean bad things don't happen, but it does mean that it's different for you because you don't react the same way. Does that make sense?
Absolutely, is a great question. And I face it, of course, teaching Buddhist philosophy or Hindu philosophy or Zen philosophy, enlightenment philosophy, with students who are struggling to say, how are they going to manage in the world? And there's a lot of mystique around the language of enlightenment, which is what I, as a philosopher, prefer to use: awakened mind, awakening. Enlightenment suggests that, oh, you are this rare being who has achieved enlightenment and once and for all. That's not the case. The enlightenment teachers understood. If reality is an infinite field of flow and interconnectivity, and you have somehow manage through great discipline to awaken your mind, to learn how to surf those interconnected flow and being in the zone, so to speak, you can hit potholes, and you will hit potholes. The reason being is that enlightenment doesn't mean you are omniscient and have complete infinite knowledge. It means you are an open, awakened, growing, learning human being. As the Zen would say, when the master who is ostensibly awakened gets spattered with mud, she smiles. Right? You're going to get spattered with mud. You're going to hit potholes because reality is an infinite field of ever-shifting ground. So a quarterback in the zone, so to speak, who gets sacked, or the great skater in the world championship final skating event who falls in the triple turn and bounces right up graciously, that's the mark of being an awakened being. So being awakened doesn't mean it's all worked out. You're learning, because reality is made that way, thank goodness. It's an ever-deepening drama. Your enlightenment is a path of ever-deepening awakening and a learning, so that things happen. And what you said nicely is that when you stumble and fall, or you lose a loved one, or some tragic event happens, the mark of enlightenment is you don't get broken by it. You see it in perspective. Enlightenment is perspectivity, the capacity to understand and listen for the deeper wisdom that will guide you through hardship and crises. So that now on the planet, when we're facing abysmal crises of all kinds, and we have to find a way to grow up and mature and be compassionate and help one another and reach out to our entire human family and the sacred earth as a sacred environment, that's what enlightenment is. It's a learning dialogue dance.
Beautiful. Okay, it's 8:48 and we have a few more minutes. What would you like to talk about that we've not already talked about?
Well, there are many ways you can go, Eva. I think in terms of my work, the book I'm working on now and bringing to conclusion, Awakening Global Enlightenment, A Great Evolutionary Shift, I'm seeking to help people understand that enlightenment, to follow the last point, is not something that's so far off for a Buddha or Jesus or Krishna or these rare individuals that achieve it. They were trying to show us, and Jesus said, you too will achieve this, you too will do greater things. It was, and Buddha was trying to help humanity find a way to end suffering, and which was seen to be, by him, this ego-based way of taking yourself to be an object, a reality, a being. And that unless you can break the ego barrier, you can't move in and mature into mindful, flourishing life, which is nirvana, which is bliss. So that the great teachers understood that enlightenment is not, and the way we put it, enlightenment is not a luxury we can't afford to deal with. I'm rather saying that enlightenment, rightly understood, is a luxury we cannot afford to neglect any longer. We are meant to be enlightened. We're meant to be awakened beings. That's what rationality is. It is the capacity to dilate our hearts and our mind and feel and see and experience a deep interconnectivity of reality with one another, to connect the dots. That's what rational coherence is. So if we know we're rational beings, we're meant to awaken. That is our heritage. That is our destiny. And now we need to do it, because we've reached a point in eons of evolution to come to this moment where, because we face the great crises on the planet, and no individual or small group can solve it, humanity has to solve it. We, the people, have to somehow mature and awaken from the ego pillar to the Buddha fly, as I playfully suggest, and realize that we are born for enlightenment, and it is user-friendly, and it is the awakening of our rational nature, and it's the maturing of our species to become a full, awakened human being.
Now, I know Irvin Laszlo. He's a friend of mine, and I know that Irvin feels like there is a time is of the essence for the work that we're doing. Do you feel that push too? And if what reason do you feel that time is of the essence? And do you have a time period that you see in mind that this needs to occur?
Well, that's a good follow-up question, Eva. Irvin Laszlo is a very close friend. He's my partner. We are co-chairs of the World Wisdom Council, and I asked him to be one of the co-chairs of our World Commission on Global Consciousness. So he and I are working very closely. We were just about 4 or 5 years ago in front of 5,000 people in Tokyo with many of our leaders, launching a campaign to help bring a critical mass shift in consciousness. And we both agree, and our leaders agree, that that we have reached a tipping point in our evolutionary drama. That's the term that he, Irvin, uses, a tipping point. I speak of a shift. You're in the midst of a great shift in consciousness. And this is in the air. You must have picked this up, Eva, all around. There are many ways of wording it, but one in terms of the Mayan calendar, many of the indigenous calendars speak of the 2012 moment of a great shift. And we don't have to buy into that literally, because even if we didn't have the Mayan calendar, I think if the wisdom of our planet and the science of understanding the crises we face brings us to the edge of realizing we can't keep this going this way much longer. We are at a point, a break point, a tipping point, a shift point, however you word it, in which somehow we've reached the crisis in the 11th hour of our evolutionary journey. And we're going to have to find the wisdom and listen to that wisdom. And I think that's my great faith in humanity. It's in the 11th hour, after all, that great evolutionary shifts take place. And I think we're facing that kind of 11th hour. In other words, we don't have another 100 years to really have a significant mass breakthrough in how we are dealing with our world. And it traces down to our dominant form of consciousness and patterns of consciousness. I think it's in our face. And we are at a crisis point, and Irvin and I agree with many, many leaders that it's urgent that we somehow find a way to upscale our consciousness, whatever language you'd like to use. I've called it conscious evolution. We're not victims of evolution. Our consciousness has taught us, and our wisdom teachers have made it clear, that we have a choice, and we're facing a great moment of choice now.
So we only have like 2 minutes left. So the bottom, and correct me if I'm wrong, the bottom line of what you're saying is that agape, we treat every single living thing that we encounter, trees, animals, plants, people, our children, our employers, wherever it is, our enemies, the ones that we don't like, the immigrants that come into our cities that people complain about, we treat them like we want to be treated, because what goes around comes around and will affect that mass consciousness tipping point. Is that correct?
You're basically speaking that classical wisdom. I think we need to be compassionate human beings, so to put it in an abbreviated way. Which is, and the reason for that, Eva, is that if we realize that the field surrounding us, whatever you call it, whether you use Yahweh or Christ or God, or Buddha, nature, or Om, or Tao, on and on, Allah, whatever name you use for the infinite field, it's infinite, and it fills every iota of life. We are surrounded by the infinite field. We're permeated in every cell. And that's why it's sacred, and everything around us is sacred. As Blake the poet said, for example, there's infinity in a grain of sand, and eternity in an hour. Or that mustard seed that Jesus spoke of, if you have faith the size of a mustard seed, you can move mountains. Or as Gandhi understood the satya, the ompar, the satya force that he sought to bring to the politics of India, to liberate India. And Martin Luther King picked up some of these themes and brought them to the civil rights movement. These kinds of leaders are trying to model this kind of life of becoming a fully empowered human being. And that is our heritage, and that is our evolutionary drama.
Thank you, Dr. Gangadhan, for taking the time to come on my show tonight. I hope at some point you'll come back. And I applaud your efforts and everything that you do. I think it's so important. And one more time, where can we find you?
Well, again, one of the easy ways on the internet, go to my website, www.awakeningmind.org. And that will give you all kinds of links to follow up on this conversation. And Amy, it's been a pleasure hearing your voice, and thank you for holding this space on the radio.
Thank you, and good night.
Good night.
Hi, this is Elliot Dasher, author of Integral Health. Integral Health. You can hear me and others speaking about consciousness and health. Just tune in every Sunday evening at 7 p.m. to Infinite Consciousness with Eva Harris.